Report from the April 2016 issue of Harper's Magazine. Legalize It All, How to Win the War on Drugs by Dan Baum. Colorado has allowed medical marijuana since 2000 through a system of licensed private dispensaries. The state originally required marijuana businesses to be vertically integrated. Dispensaries could sell only what they grew themselves, a replication of the old tied houses. The theory was that this was easier to regulate businesses from seed to sale. In November 2012, 55% of voters approved Amendment 64 to the Colorado Constitution, which legalized recreational marijuana. The initiative was strategically timed. Having marijuana on the ballot helped draw young progressive voters to win the state for President Obama. After the election, Colorado chose a system of licensed businesses over state monopoly. In 2014, it dropped the requirement that recreational dispensaries be vertically integrated. One business can now grow marijuana for another to sell. As soon as Governor John Hickenlooper formalized the results, 5 weeks after the vote, Coloradans 21 years of age and older could legally possess and use marijuana. Stores and commercial cultivators were not allowed to open, though, until January 2014, 14 months after the vote. The delay was meant to allow the state time to expand the Marijuana Enforcement Division within the Department of Revenue to incorporate retail marijuana into its jurisdiction and to allow the division to write rules concerning signage, advertising, waste disposal, video surveillance, labeling, taxes, and required distances from schools. Already, legal marijuana in Colorado is following the grim economics of alcohol. Daily smokers make up only 23% of the state's pot-smoking population, but they consume 67% of the reefer. That may have been true when marijuana was illegal. Maybe the number of daily stoners is neither rising nor falling. We'll never know, because one problem with illegal markets is that you can't track them. But we do know that legal for-profit marijuana business in Colorado is already mimicking the alcohol business and its dependence on heavy users. From a public health standpoint, that's troubling. The effect of legalization on crime has been difficult to determine. Overall, crime fell in Denver by almost 2% in 2014, the first year of full marijuana legalization. And strangely, surveys of 40,000 teenagers before and after legalization showed that although fewer now believed marijuana to be harmful, just as the opponents of legalization predicted, fewer were smoking pot. Were they lying? Was it a statistical anomaly? Are pot dealers harder to find now that they're competing with legal stores? Or is it possible that marijuana, once legalized, lost its cachet? Colorado has run into glitches. The 14 months between the vote and the opening of stores wasn't enough time to write regulations on such variables as pesticide use in cultivation or dosages in edibles. Nor was there time to write new training curriculum for police, who found themselves not knowing exactly what to do about the large quantities of marijuana they were encountering. People have been stringing extension cords together to make their own grow rooms and burning down their homes. They've pumped so much water into pot cultivation that monstrous blooms of black mold have rendered their houses uninhabitable. And Denver has seen a spate of burglaries and robberies at marijuana greenhouses and stores. The law let local jurisdictions decide whether to allow retail pot stores. Only 35 counties did so at first, which is partly why the state received only $12 million in new marijuana taxes in the first 6 months of legal pot sales, about a third of what regulators had anticipated. "That's changing," said Lewis Koski, 44-year-old who's deputy senior director of Colorado's Enforcement Division, in 2014. "Just about every week we have new jurisdictions allowing it. It may also be that the state set the tax on retail marijuana too high, 10% on top of the usual sales tax. Some smokers are apparently continuing to buy on the black market, which is often cheaper. It may be that almost everybody who wanted to buy legal pot already had a medical marijuana ID card. 111,000 Coloradans, more than 2% of the population, hold them, and medical pot carries only the regular sales tax." Still, in 2015, Colorado collected about $135 million in marijuana taxes and fees, almost double what it took in the year before. Cracking down on unlicensed growing operations and training crops has been relatively easy. What's going to be tougher is keeping big business from overwhelming the exercise and rigging the game. Even with only 4 states and the District of Columbia having legalized and only 23 states allowing the medical use of marijuana, legitimate production is already at a $5.4 billion industry. Forbes has published a list of the 8 hottest publicly traded marijuana companies. Cannabis stocks include biotech companies, makers of specialized vending machines, and manufacturers of vaporizers that allow inhalation without tar or burning the product. The combined value of marijuana stocks rose by 50% in 2013 and by 150% in the first 3 weeks of 2014 before settling down to a still impressive 38% gain for the year. In September 2014, M. Jardine, a maker of turnkey growing operations, announced that it was considering an initial public offering. Even the Wall Street Journal analyzes marijuana as serious investment opportunity. These enormous bets are being placed at a time when recreational marijuana is still illegal in 46 states and under federal law. The citizens of U.S. jurisdictions that legalized marijuana may have set in motion more machinery than most of them had imagined. Without marijuana prohibition, the government can't sustain the drug war, Ira Glasser, who ran the American Civil Liberties Union from 1978 to 2001, told me. Without marijuana, the use of drugs is negligible, and you can't justify the law enforcement and prison spending on other drugs. Their use is vanishingly small. I always thought if you could cut the marijuana head off the beast, the drug war couldn't be sustained. Even in my hometown of Boulder, which may be the most pot-friendly city in the United States, it's not marijuana gone wild, as Jane Brodigam, the city manager, told officials from Colorado and Washington during a public conference call in September 2014. People were, for the most part, feeling okay about it, she said. Marijuana charges in Colorado were down 80%. Only 2,000 or so Coloradans were charged for marijuana offenses in 2014, as opposed to nearly 10,000 in 2011. Brodigam has had to shut down a few marijuana businesses for violations, but no more than in any other industries. There was an implication that there would be people smoking all over the place, she said. That hasn't happened. When I checked in with her office in January, things were still going well. Patrick Von Kaeserling, the city communications director, told me, in large part because it's a very well-regulated industry. To the extent that we in Colorado think about legal marijuana, now that the initial excitement has worn off, we have a smug sense that we have taken the lead in doing something smart. We are as divided as any place over immigrants, guns, and climate change, but our police don't waste their time chasing down pot smokers anymore. Adults don't have to worry, as they used to, about neighbors smelling reefer smoke wafting from their patios. Even if marijuana tax revenues, which are slated to help public schools, aren't what we'd hoped for, our state is making money from something that used to cost it money. Marijuana is no big deal. We look at other states that treat it as a public menace and wonder what in the world they're thinking. Nobody I spoke with in the United States or elsewhere envisioned stores selling heroin, cocaine, or methamphetamine as freely as Colorado stores sell marijuana or as state liquor stores sell vodka. The way most researchers imagine hard drug distribution, short of state monopoly, involves some kind of supervision. A network of counselors, not necessarily physicians, would monitor how a drug fits into a person's life. When Kleiman at NYU allows himself to imagine legal cocaine, he pictures users setting their own dose. You can decide whether you want to raise your quota, a bureaucratic process, or see someone about your cocaine problem. This is to give your long-term self a fighting chance against your short-term self. Eric Sterling, the executive director of the Anti-Prohibition Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, envisions a similar system. Someone might say, I want cocaine because it stimulates me in my creative work, or I want cocaine to improve my orgasms. The response might be, why don't you have enough energy? Do you exercise? Or what might be interfering with the current quality of your sex life? Those who want to try LSD or other psychedelics, Sterling suggests, might go to licensed trip leaders, analogous to wilderness guides, people trained, indemnified, and insured to take the uninitiated into potentially dangerous territory. Of course, it's easy to imagine people who enjoy cocaine, heroin, or psychedelics saying, to hell with all that, and continuing to buy on the black market. But as Sterling points out, doing so is risky. If someone as rich and well-connected as Philip Seymour Hoffman can die of a heroin shot, nobody is safe. Also, as Sterling notes, it's a hassle to be an addict. Find a dealer, score, find a place to get off. If lawful, a regulated system is fine-tuned. So the drugs are cheap and trustworthy, the process is not too burdensome, and taxes on them are not too high. Users will likely come to prefer it to the black market. Competition, not violence, will destroy the criminal gangs that control illegal drug distribution. Ultimately, this is all about building the proper cultural context for using drugs, Sterling says, a context in which the exaggerations and the falsehoods get extinguished. In 2009, Britain's Transform Drug Policy Foundation put out a 232-page report called After the War on Drugs, Blueprint for Regulation. The authors suggested issuing licenses for buying and using drugs, with sanctions for those who screw up, much like gun licenses in some U.S. states, or driver's licenses. Users would have their purchases tracked by a computer, so rising use would in theory be noticed, making intervention possible. Legal vendors would bear partial responsibility for socially destructive incidents, the way bartenders can be held responsible for serving an obvious drunk who later has an accident behind the wheel. For pricing, the report suggests prices high enough to discourage misuse and sufficiently low to ensure that undercutting is not profitable for illicit drug suppliers. And although the British group argued for a regular, generally more laissez-faire market than European and Canadian government-run heroin distribution systems, it embraced a complete ban on any kind of advertising and marketing and argued instead for plain pharmaceutical-style packaging. You were just listening to a report called Legalize It All, How to Win the War on Drugs by Dan Baum. He's the author of four books, most recently Gun Guys 2013.